Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and our favorite media. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I have got my stalwart companion, Matt Rossi, with me today. How are you doing today, Matt?
It's kind of weird. I've been playing a lot of Baldur's Gate. I'm sure people know that. I haven't been making a secret of it. One of my playthroughs is really bizarre in that I have not gotten all the way to Kethric Thorn yet. I mean, I know the plot of the game. But I haven't gotten to Kethric Thorn yet, but I am level 9.
So you mentioned that in chat, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, I have the same problem on my current playthrough with my elf monk. And I realized, like, after you mentioned it, I started going through, like, the mental Rolodex. It really is, like, the amount of things you can do in Act 1 in that game is astronomical.
Yeah, I am still not through with Act 1, and I have done a lot of things, obviously, because I'm level 9. I am kind of destroying everything in my path now, because you're level 9 in Act 1. I'm not playing on hard mode or anything, and it's just like things are falling apart when they fight me.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was going to say, for context, 12 is the cap in the game.
Yeah, 12 is the level you will be at when you go to fight the hardest things in the game. And while Kethric Thorn isn't a joke or anything, he certainly isn't prepared for a bunch of level 9s to show up. I also had a bug for a while where I had everybody in my party.
Yes.
Like, everyone. They were all there. They would come out to, like, you know, I'd go to, like, Joaquin's Rest or whatever, and I'd have, like, you know, every single person with me. Like, there's you know, even Asterion and Laezel, Shadowheart, Gale. You already see a problem because that's already four people plus me. I had all of them. And then I got Karlach, and she was there too. I think it was because it was before they put in the thing where, like, they say, you know, your party's too crowded. Make room. They put that in recently, but I think this game was from before that. So when I was playing it, I don't know what happened, but just everyone joined up for a while. And it wasn't until the part where Laezel leaves the party because she sees the Githyanki on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
When she did that, then she wouldn't come back to the party. And she's like, dismiss someone. I'm like, all right, okay, it's fixed itself. And because I don't want to cheat, I dismissed someone. She just still didn't join the party. So I dismissed someone else. And until I dismissed enough people, she wouldn't join the party. So I had to do that like 5 times. But then, you know, I had the party was back to its original size of 4 people. I personally think the party should be 5 people.
Yeah, when we talked about this on the regular podcast, and I think this also ties in with, I promise you at home, this does tie in with Lore Watch here in my thoughts.
I've also got a story element reason for saying that too, but let Joe go.
I firmly believe that 5 is the perfect tabletop role-playing game size, period. Because it allows you to have enough folks, enough bodies that, you know, you can throw larger scale encounters and people are less likely to be overwhelmed or feel overwhelmed because there's enough folks to do it. But also it creates an interesting dynamic. We talk a lot about how a lot of games are developed around the idea of the Holy Trinity of classes. There's a certain thing to that with player personality, too, which has led me to believe that 5 players balances it usually, not always, usually in like the perfect mix. You have your outgoing ones, you have your role players, you have your number crunchers, and you have the people that are sort of like in between that help you advance the story because you don't have to worry about, you know, one particular aspect and the game sort of going one way or over another. And so you can have that well-rounded story. You can have the story, you can have the role-playing, you can have the battle mechanics, you can have a little bit of everything, which is kind of what role-playing games really, they sort of want. Even the more narrative ones still have encounters that happen occasionally.
Mm-hmm. So, unless someone tells you outright that it is a narrative story game and not an actual RPG, then the combat is actually meant to be important.
Mm-hmm.
Narrative story games, the combat, if it even exists, is not meant to be important. But one of the things I was thinking about as I did it was, first off, this one's not role-playing related. This one's just gaming purpose, so I'll get through it fast. With the entire party with me, I wasn't so annoyed by Larian's version of turn-based. because I didn't have to sit on my hands as long waiting because I have a guy somewhere in the order. You know what I mean? Like, usually when Larian does it, you end up with like all these goblins going in a chunk or whatever, and then you go before them and you go after them. But with the entire group there, you've got enough ranges of initiative that some people go first, some people go in the middle, some people go last. And it's not so much, okay, then waiting for this guy to go over there. Yeah, okay, this guy is doing that. Yeah. And to me, that really got rid of that problem. Also, there's more opportunities for the NPCs to talk and combinations you might not normally get. Like, how often do you have Will, Karlach, and Shadowheart and Lazelle all together? Never, because one of them would be you.
Unless you're playing as one of the origin characters. Yeah.
Yeah. Even then, though, one of them would be
you. When you're the origin character, you don't do the voice lines.
Nope.
But
in a weird sort of way, that's why I like not playing the origin characters.
But that makes sense, though, too, because then you get to experience more of the story because of those interactions. And there are some interesting story moments. And also, there's relationship level up. Mm-hmm. Between them in those moments where like Will and Karlach are like a really good example of that. When you have them in your party at the same time, as you go through things, they start to learn more about each other and interact more. And like it that's a huge part of that type of game. So it does again, come back to the story element of it where five really is a unique, perfect number, which is why I also, it's the only mod I ever installed for Baldur's Gate 3, which is the one that lets you have as many people in the party as you want. There's a mod on, and we can talk about this after the podcast.
We will be talking about this after the podcast.
But I did that specifically so that I could have five people in my party because it is the perfect mix. But now that I've rocked Matt's world with the revelation that he can do this with the mod.
I keep forgetting that I can mod things because I'm so used to playing on console.
Yeah.
And I mean, I am playing this game on console, but I mean, I'm also playing it on PC because I can do both now because of cross save. So maybe I shouldn't mod it because then it might screw up the console stuff.
We can talk about it afterwards.
But yeah, so let's do it like our jobs.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So now that we've talked about that, we're going to be talking about your questions that your wonderful listeners have sent in to us. If you have questions for this or any of our podcasts, be sure to send those into podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Specify the show that it is for, and if you have a special pronunciation for your name, please include that as well. You can also hit us up on our Discord channels. We have one that is the Q&A Podcast Questions channel. It's open for everybody. Same rules apply. And if you are a Patreon subscriber, you can go to our Patreon Q&A Podcast Questions channel, where we tend to look for first because it's a way of saying thank you for helping us keep the lights on. There is not a pronunciation with this one, so if I mispronounce this name, I apologize. Peristalith says, Follow up on Kalch's post on the Azerothian archives. What historical places on Azeroth should the archives dig up next? Once the bugs get fixed and improvements made, do you think the Azerothian archives could be a successful successor to archaeology? Should these open world dig, world quests, and the weekly big dig event sites be that profession replacement, because you have not heard anything about the archaeology profession update in a long time? So did you do any of the Azerothian archive stuff, Matt?
Yeah.
And what did you think of it?
I think it has much more promise than has actually currently been realized with it. And I think this question strikes to the heart of what I would like to see it be. In other words, I'm just saying, yes, do that. I agree with you. It's a good idea. I have more to say, but I feel like if we're just asking me what I think of the Azerothian archives, I think that they need to be bigger and more ambitious. And I think that making them a replacement for archaeology, or a replacement for time walking, or a replacement for nothing, just in the game, in a way that they can be, you know, like, we haven't had a Caverns of Time dungeon in a while, and quite frankly, they could fill that role. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of roles they could fill. Right now, they're sort of not filling any of them, and I would like them to fill one of them, if not more of them.
Yeah, and I think for me, it's an interesting, like, your question hits on something that I've been thinking about a lot, which is archaeology was this really cool secondary thing that you could do that was completely separate from the game. It was its own little mini game in the same way that, like, pet battles are. But it told stories. Like, you were able to get pieces of history that gave you tidbits of lore. And sometimes those tidbits of lore and those things that you dug up gave you a reward, like a skeleton raptor mount. Or, you know, I forgot what other rewards there were, but there was a number of them.
Are we talking for archaeology rewards? Yeah,
archaeology.
There were weapon ones, too. In fact, there was one in particular. There was like a reborn Jinrok, the one that,
yes,
the one that used to be in Zul'Gurub. And I mean, I hammered archaeology into the freaking ground, and I never got that sword.
Yeah, but I mean, then there's other stuff like the staff of Thane Thresian was in there as well.
Yep, and there was like an outfit that Ashara wore and stuff like that. There were some interesting things in there.
Or the Chalice of the Mountain Kings, which was the dwarf one that it's a toy, but it also summons spectral dwarves to dance and celebrate with you. The point is, like, you got a lot of very interesting things potentially out of it that, in a lot of cases, they told stories or they gave you bits and pieces of little things that existed, like Queen Ajara's dressing gown, you know, where, like, it's Queen Ajara's dressing gown. You find Taranda's favorite doll, I think, is one of them as well. It's a trinket, but it did belong to Taranda as she was growing up. And it's this thing that lets you, I remember it was something that let you recoup mana. And I remember that because at the time, every healer I knew was going out and digging for it. But it still gave you sort of that Night Elf flavor of, oh, this is what they did when they were kids. So, like, archaeology had an interesting place, but we haven't done anything with it in a very, very, very long time.
Yeah, they put it in, and then it literally hasn't gotten much of anything. I think the last time it got anything was Mists of Pandaria, wasn't it?
No, there's stuff that was added as recently as Battle for Azeroth, but you can see the number of things go drastically down, right? So, like, in Mists of Pandaria, you had the Mogu artifacts, the Pandaren artifacts, the Manton artifacts, and Warlords of Draenor.
There's a fair amount, yeah.
But there wasn't really. There was maybe what?
Compared to what I've seen since. But yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it wasn't
each,
that many.
Each thing had maybe a dozen things versus before, like even the gray items, you know, in earlier iterations had like, you know, two dozen or, you know, more. I think it's interesting that they stopped after Battle for Azeroth. We didn't get anything in Shadowlands, which I guess makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, what are we going to be digging? You know, archaeology in Shadowlands seems like an interesting prospect. I think it could have worked in the Maw. Like, I have always said this. I felt like that they really kind of glossed over the Maw, because when Zoval was the Arbiter, when he was the Arbiter, obviously the area that's now the Maw wasn't the Maw. It was something else. It was where they originally, you know, that there's even that weird beam that's coming out of the top of his tower. That's, that feels very connected to the, you know, the place, the city. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the name of that bloody city now, but we've talked about it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I feel like you could have done something with archaeology there, like finding like remnants of the past. Like that area that broke off and that Zoval chained back in could have been brought into it too. Like, you know, this was a piece of it that broke off and flew away. And that's why he was able to chain it and pull it back. And now that's, you could do more archaeology there. It is kind of interesting that they didn't even try in that one. You're right on that.
And I think Azerothian Archives presents an interesting way to sort of replace what we, I think, what archaeology tried to do a little bit of, which is tell more of a story, tell more of the history of different places or heritages. And I think you could do something like that, where you have these open world dig sites that end in a big dig event and whatever the kit, you know, whether it's, you know, we're searching for Titan artifacts or we're searching for, you know, Silithid artifacts and Silithus, and or Night Elf artifacts, because they're spread throughout the world. You have all these cool events in history and all these zones that have, you know, we've seen there were archaeological digs way back when. Remember, I'm trying to remember if this was, I think this was back during like the vanilla days, where there was that statue with the sword driven through it.
You sure it was? I think it was actually, what do you call it? Go on, I'll remember.
But it was a faceless one, essentially, that had the sword dug
through it. Yeah,
that's the one. And we didn't know what faceless ones were yet, and it was, it had.
All we could see was the very tip of it, yeah, so we didn't even know what it looked like. Just the very top of it had that giant statue sticking out of it, yeah. And that's where Rem Travel's dig was, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where Rem Travel's dig was, but there was a bunch of sites of that, because the Explorers League, and I can't ever remember the one on the Horde side, I apologize, but they would always be at these dig sites throughout the world, and you didn't interact with it unless you were going in to murder them or to take some of their stuff. But turning those locations into actual Azerothian archives, I think would be really neat. Or going back to, why can't I think of the goblin starting area?
Oh, Kejistan?
Yeah. It's not Kejistan. Kejistan's Diablo.
Right. Sorry. But no, going but back, Kazan, the Isle of Kazan.
Kazan.
But and Undermine.
But going back there and maybe excavating and like dealing with the aftermath of the volcano explosion, treating it like Pompeii, and like doing an archaeological dig to like recover pieces of the goblins' history and past and heritage, I think would be really cool. There's an opportunity that they could turn this into something that allows them to tell older stories in the retail version to give us context to things that we wouldn't normally have before. And I think if they can get the bugs worked out, I think this would potentially be not just a successful successor to archaeology, but could be the superior archaeology. And then,
by the way, the Blood Elves thing is the reliquary. That's the Horde version now.
Thank you.
Yeah, I had to go look it up. I was going insane. But yeah, I think too, when we look at it, it's got a lot of potential to replace archaeology, because it does a lot of similar things, just in a different way. Like you can get all that lore stuff from the various world quests you do. You got the items you can pick up with the whatever the currency for it is. You have like 10,000 mysterious tomes or whatever. There's the pets that kind of give you a sense of the area as well. Like there's mounts, there's pets. You know, there's stuff here that gives you an idea of like what you found. And I think that it made sense to do it in a Dragonflight, because, you know, you were like exploring a place nobody had been for a long time. I mean, not nobody, but these people hadn't been there for a long time. So I definitely think that that's there, but I also think you could use it. I really do think you could use it to either do Caverns of Time style dungeons, or, you know, like exploring a ruin and getting to see things. Like you could get to certain points and, I don't know, use the archivist's like globe, and it would like basically give you the version of an area's like hit past. You could, similar to like the play you got in Shadowlands, or the stuff that they were doing in Mists of Pandaria with the, I want to say Lore Keepers. Like, you remember the, like, you would go up.
Yeah, the Lore Keeper Cho and them. Yep.
Yeah. You would go up to the top of the tower, and you would just, you know, give that, you would talk to them, and they would play various things from history. Like, you got to see the Mogu deciding to turn themselves back to stone and stuff like that. And I think I honestly feel like this is would be a good idea. I want to see the Lore Keepers come back, quite frankly. I don't know why the Lore Keepers are not showing up for stuff as momentous as we've been getting.
Yeah, and we talked about that before, too, where, like, I really thought that they would be a really good vehicle to, like, we talked about it being able to catch up mechanics, but just in general, the fact that they're part of the world now, and, like, I would have expected that we would have been seeing many of the Lore Keepers traveling around, gathering stories and digging into things, or maybe giving life to stories, because that's kind of what they do, right? That's what their magic does. You know, reliving epic battles and epic tales and, you know, giving sort of those pieces back to the people, especially now, like, we have Bellamath, right? And if I could see a Lore Keeper with all the new Night Elf children that are, you know, born into the new Elven capital, which is essentially what it is, or all the Elven children that join there, and, like, having these things where they tell them about the history of the elves, and it's a, like, not just the play, but it's the representation that using that magic that the Lore Keepers have to, like, bring them up to speed to keep their traditions and their memories alive. And I'm with you. I don't understand why we haven't seen more of the Lore Keepers.
Yeah. And especially since, I mean, one of the things that I think we've got enough groups that would work really well.
Sorry, Lore Walkers.
Lore Walkers. Yeah. Sorry. But if we had, like, right now we have the Bronze Dragons have the time. Is they Time Walkers or Timekeepers or something? I can't remember their name.
Time Walkers.
Time Walkers. You've got those guys. You've got the Lore Walkers. I really feel like at this point you could have this, you know, both the Reliquary and the Explorers League were working together on the Dragonflight. And I don't see any reason they couldn't keep doing it since we're trying to move away from the Horde Alliance hating each other. Imagine if there was essentially this sort of council of people who want to know stuff. I realize that's a terrible name, but, like, you know, the historians charter or something, where they all get together and use their various abilities to look into the history of the world. Like, you know, Lore Keepers with their ability to recreate stories, Lore Walkers, sorry, Time Walkers with their ability to literally go into the past. And, you know, both the Explorers League and the Reliquary guys for their various expertises, because they all have a lot of stuff. They might have an expert in something that the other groups don't have. And also everybody's ability to bother us at a moment's notice to get us to do their work for them, because that happens a lot. Mm-hmm. And honestly, if that group existed, if your character has done any of the previous expansions, they've done something ridiculous that this group should want to know about. Like, they should be asking you to stop and talk a lot. Like, just so then you went back in time. Oh yeah, I was trying to save Chromie, and I ended up, you know, before the old gods had finished beating up on the elemental lords. So the beginning of the Black Empire. Anyway, C'Thun noticed me, and it was all a thing. Wait a minute, an old god noticed you? Oh yeah, he said, that, you know, you are familiar, except not. Oh yeah, there's that time you put a hat on me, you know, and I just imagine everybody's jaws constantly hitting the floor as you just tell these random stories. So yeah, then I punched Ragnaros. He got up out of the lava. He had legs. Do you know Ragnaros has legs? Yeah, it was weird. So yeah, I feel like this is a thing that they should do. But, you know, I am often not in step with where we're going, so we'll see what happens. But I definitely would love to see it. I definitely think you should. There's so much potential there. They should do something more with it. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. And it's really the potential of it is what I love the most. And mm-hmm. I would love to see it explored, because it's been a while since we've had something that had that potential, right? Like, we haven't had something that has been sort of ripe for the next steps. And I would like to see it explored. I hope that answers your question. I think we're going to move on to our next one. So this one comes from our friend Flan, otherwise known as Flanageddon, Cyberpunk Edition. All right. I'm a bit confused as to when people start getting implants. We see in Edgerunners that high schoolers are adept at using their chips, But in Phantom Liberty, spoiler, V comes across a kid who's been chipped and chromed and gets quite upset by this. Is this a case of you're old enough to drive, you're old enough for cybernetic augmentation, or closer to little Tommy has an iPad to stop borrowing mommy and daddy's? Matt?
Well, first off, think about the fact that V, all right, this is going to require some spoilers for the end of Phantom Liberty. I'm going to try and keep them as vague as possible, but at one point you find out that even if you are no longer able to use cyberware because you've had traumatic brain injury that's essentially made it so that cyberware will kill you, like you just can't run it, you can still use the chip that allows you to make calls, you know, in your head and have a HUD. That still works. It's extremely non-invasive by Cyberpunk standards. In Cyberpunk 2077, that level, like the ports in your head and the chipset, is literally like the iPhone or iTablet you get your kid. It is so pervasive that it's rare people don't have them, at least in urban areas. There's other places where, you know, if you live out with a nomad, you might not have it. But for most people living in an urban area, even people who are not doing really well probably have at least the outdated version of this.
Yeah, it's an easy way of keeping communication. It's an easy way of getting information. It's an easy way. Like, you see it with the kids in particular. You see it with them in Edgerunners. It's used for school, right? Yeah. They tab in for lessons. They jack in for virtual learning sessions. It's there.
So that's different than the stuff V was objecting to. V was not objecting this kid has a chip in their head. This kid can get on the net or whatever. V was objecting that they're taking a 12-year-old and replacing its muscles.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of like giving a child steroids.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
It's actually like, yeah, it's like if you first started giving children steroids, then decided, okay, we're also going to do that operation on you where we break your legs and then pull them apart so that they'll grow taller. Like, imagine doing that on a 12-year-old to make them a better basketball player. Because that's what they were literally replacing body parts. And you see the effects of it. Like, there's a couple of, I don't want to call them cyber psychos, because they're not called cyber psychos in Phantom Liberty. In Dogtown, they're called something else, and I can't remember what it is. But there's a couple of people that you fight who are the cast-off remnants of that process. One of them was like a world famous basketball player, and then he just lost it and started going and like he started killing people. And then there was like a fighter, like a boxer, who just went. He went so bad that the animals didn't want him fighting them anymore. He was insane and incredibly jacked up, and he was 19 years old when you meet him. He's already a washed up, crazy loser psycho, and he's 19. Like, he has no life because they just modded him to beyond threshold. They modded him worse than Razor Hughes is modded, and he was like 15 when they started doing this to him. The body is the thing about cyberware is, if you want to keep the balance, like if you want to avoid stuff like cyberpsychosis, you have to let the body achieve as much stability as it can before you start sticking massive alterations in. And while some implants can actually prolong lifespan, some are extremely invasive. Like, if you have like a Kerenznikov / Sandovistin, that is astonishingly invasive. You have just basically replaced your nervous system. You've taken your nervous system and said, we want much more efficient nerves. And also this thing that will kick it up several notches. Because think about how wild it is that you can, if you have the right Sandevistan, you can slow time by like 80%. Like you're wandering around and everybody looks like they're in slow motion while you just casually walk up to them and take their guns out of their hands or shoot them or whatever, what have you. And that thing, they were putting that in a 10-year-old. Their neurons haven't even finished yet. You know, for some people, your brain connections don't finish until you're in your mid-20s. They're putting it in a 10-year-old. You know, and the same thing with a lot of it. So a lot of it, the stuff V was objecting to was the extreme, almost military-grade cyberware that they were putting in these kids just so they'd be good at a sport for a few years. And then when they're 20, they're essentially going to be washed up. Go ahead, Joe.
I was going to say, the thing to consider, too, is that's what was happening here. But even then, it wasn't necessarily just because it's that. Because all cyberware, and we talked about this before, all cyberware has the potential to cause psychosis. All cyberware has the potential to cause irreparable damage to a person. And if you look at it in the context through V's eyes, right, V understands how this works and has sort of accepted the risks of it. All of the runners have. That's part of their you know, that's what you sign on for. And they talk with their Ripper docs, and their Ripper docs tell them how much they can take before it starts becoming an issue. These are fully developed adults in many cases that are being told what their limitations are. Children who have not fully developed don't have the mental barriers, the willpower, or the wherewithal really to sort of understand the position they're in and adapt fully to what's being implanted in them. Their threshold, for lack of a better term, is lower. And this is why you see them, like Matt's pointing out, like they're burned out by 20. They're burned out probably earlier than that because you don't know what else they're putting into it. And it could also create, there is a drug effect to a certain degree, too, with some of the stuff.
Literally, too. Like when you go through that place in Phantom Liberty and you see some of the data files and so forth, they're literally hopping these kids up on not just anti-rejection drugs, but on massive doses of baloperidol, which is the anti-cyberpsychotic drug in the future. They are putting these kids on 10 times the amount of baloperidol that they use to treat people who might actually have cyberpsychosis. They are doing whack things to these kids. There's even some possibility that they're doing genetic manipulation, which is a whole new thing to talk about. Go ahead, Joe.
I was going to say, that's something we don't generally talk about, but that is something that it does exist in Cyberpunk and Shadowrun universe, where there are corporations that dabble in genetic manipulation, whether it's before they're even born and doing it to unborn embryos, or whether it's you're paying for designer organs that have been chemically grown in a vat and everything in between. So we don't know if they were doing that, but there's certainly hints of it. There's certainly hints that there was genetic manipulation.
There's likely another. Go ahead.
I was going to say likely to try to push them to have a higher threshold would be my guess.
Yeah, because we know that there's a genetic fluke that one in 10,000 people has, that David Ramirez had, that V supposedly has, if you're looking at the new talents you get, where you just have a higher ability to tolerate cyberware. And there's a quest. It's not even a quest. It's if you're driving through the Biotechnica compound, that huge farm area, you can come upon a truck that's by the side of the road with all these dead people. And you go through and like they're all just there dead. And you find like a data thing on one of the bodies who is essentially named, like, I think it was I can't remember the actress who plays Furiosa in the Mad Max movie. They named her to the name Charisse Fury, and because it's a reference to the latest Mad Max movie, but Fury Road. But when you read the slate, it's like, you know, they are taking pregnant women out of Biotechnica by force, extracting them. And one of the girls had managed to survive the chase from Biotechnica, and she's talking to Dakota, who is like one of the fixers, and Dakota's like, "Look, if this goes bad, get that girl and get out of there. You know that we need what she's carrying, because she's carrying a genetically modified human inside her. Like they've been modifying her her kid's DNA in the womb. And that's not the only time Biotechnica does stuff like that. There's a quest from where you go kill a Biotechnica bigwig because she was doing a genetic modification thing that killed an entire nomad tribe, like a couple hundred of them, I think.
Yep.
And we never find out what they were trying to do, but it wasn't like the goal of this wasn't to kill them. Them dying was a complete fluke. But there's a whole bit where when you go into her apartment to kill her, you can look on her computer, and there's a thing about how, you know, they did get the resistance to something that they wanted, but then the neurons all blew up and they all died. So there was some progress. And what is this? We don't know. But we know that they're doing stuff like that. And we know that Biotechnica was involved in that school thing that we go to because it was on the Biotechnica campus in Dogtown. That was all Biotechnica stuff. That whole area was Biotechnica showing off what it was going to be doing. It's like, look at all this stuff we're going to do in the future. It was like a big Biotechnica expo, and that lab is in the basement of it. So yeah, it's all tied together. And that's the real horror of cyberpunk as a world, is that this stuff, it's so pervasive that everything we're talking about is like the worst case scenario, but it's not uncommon for high school football players to get modified in cyberpunk. It is impossible to be a football player in cyberpunk without heavy augmentation.
However, like in the actual like mythos of the world, they sort of, those augmentations do happen, but mm-hmm. the sports groupings dictate what they can be modified to. Think of it like legalized juicing almost, where mm-hmm. it's like they tell you can have so much of this inside of you, and you can have these types of augmentations, and that's it. You're like Adam Smasher couldn't come in and then decide he's going to be a fullback right?
No. But the point is that it's gotten to the point where people are comfortable with that. That's mm-hmm. It's like the old Overton window idea. The window on what's acceptable for cyberware is already so high that it takes a lot to push people. Like the fact that V is angry is entirely because, like everything Joe said, like about how V knows the risks. Plus V knows that for every Ripper Doc like her, you know, like Vic. I want to say Vic. Yeah, thank you, Vic. For every Ripper Doc like Vic, there's a ton of Ripper Docs who are not.
Look at the one that look at the one that wind up it's a sad one, but the thing with Evelyn, the one that she was given to.
Yeah. Fingers. You know, that guy isn't gonna like put your best interest at heart. And so seeing this person who's like being trusted by the families to help their kids achieve their dreams and is just, you know, just chopping their limbs off, you know, and at a young age. Yeah, it's messed up. Although I will also mention there's something interesting to me. Like if you have like a lot of cyberware as V, one of the endings, you get it all removed. They must have grown you new limbs.
They had to have.
Yeah. So keep that in mind. They cloned a lot of V's body.
Or possibly more, all of it.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing to think about too. But we can
use it.
To answer this question as definitively as possible, it certainly is the case that a lot of people have mild to medium upgrades.
Like, yeah, and the acceptable window thing is, I think, really important here too, because you got to look at it from the context of, and I get what you're coming here, Flan, with the question, but like you got to come from the aspect of people who live in this world where this is the norm, right? Getting cyber upgrades is as commonplace as getting a new cell phone is in our world, where, you know, you can go and get the newest and greatest flagship thing. And it's, you know, gives you better camera, better, you know, battery power life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're so used to doing this. That's why Ripper Docs are everywhere. That's why there is literally corporations that do Ripper Docs, that have a network of them. You can literally go into a showroom and pick out different models, whether look at one of the things that V does early on. You get a hand implant and an eye implant. So you literally are replacing your eyes with a thing. And this is very, very commonplace. And as that becomes more normalized in that world, while V's horror at what happens with these children, and I will say disgust or disdain is legit. You can see another group or a growing number of people in the game world that don't care or that wouldn't care.
All those this people is normal. There. Yeah, there's a lot of people at that meetup who are just there to sign a kid to join their sports team. They don't give a rat's behind about, you know, the horror that V is feeling. And keep in mind, too, the other thing is V also has Johnny in her head, or his head. And Johnny's from 50 years ago. Cyberware was common, but you didn't
but not that
see
common.
Kids getting it. Yeah.
Yeah, like Johnny Silverhand was also an anomaly, too. Like, him and Atom Smasher were... they were more upgraded than most people 50 years ago.
Yeah. And the them from 50 years ago barely had any cyberware comparatively. Like, Johnny has an arm. He doesn't even have a HUD. And Atom Smasher, when you see him, he's got a new voice box and he's got like dermal armor and stuff, but he doesn't have a Sand of Easting because I don't even know if they existed.
They didn't exist yet. Yeah. Those were made by Militech after 2020.
So the goalposts have changed, but Johnny is now there in V's head. So part of their merging, their neurons are linking together. When Johnny sees this, he is absolutely disgusted, and V feels his disgust viscerally, even if they try to push it off. I think it's a combination of those two things. But I also think it's absolutely true what Joe is saying about some people, this is nothing. Other people, it's like, another thing to point out is there are TV shows and radio ads for cyberware. There's one that's just about, there's a show called Chipping In that's just promoting, and you can watch it if you're near a TV when it's on. Karina Lee is the character from the game who's the host. She will straight up, there's one time I remember sitting and just listening to her talk as she shows a scene of a bunch of maelstromers attacking an old woman who suddenly frags the lot of them, just kills them dead with these mantis blades she pops out of her arms. And she's going off about, okay, that looks like the newest model, Higurushi, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there going, so this equivalent of Top Gear is about civilians with arm cyberware. They have mantis blades in civilians. Like, that's not a cop. That's not a military contractor. That is a random citizen who has mantis blades in her arms. And that's... It's like, instead of being like, wow, or that's kind of extreme, they're like talking, they're like watching the video, and she's explaining the cyberware to people. So Arasaka gets civilian customers for its cyberware, which means Militech does too, because there's no effing way Militech will let Arasaka have that to itself, which means they all doing it. And so it's not just, you know, your Kuroshi implants, because, you know, those are eyes you need them to see. It's everything. If it is already some version of it that some random person can just have, it doesn't have to be the best of the best is still super expensive and super rare, but there's a civilian version of a cyberdeck that you could be using to hack, you know, aggressively. What's her name? Songbird talks about her first deck and how she used to steal her way onto the net. And that was back like almost 20 years before the game. She was a kid and she was doing it. So there, it's very widespread.
All right. I think that's good enough. And I think we're going to move on to our last one here.
I have to mention really fast. This has nothing to do with anything we just talked about, but I told Joe I was going to do this on the show and I want to do it. I played Cyberpunk to death. I love Cyberpunk. And now I'm playing Baldur's Gate 3. And in both those games, somebody has put a ticking time bomb in your head that talks to you and tries to make you do things. If I had a nickel for every time that happened to me in a game, it would be two nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's still weird it happened twice. You know what I mean? It's just one of those things, man. I just wanted to point that out. I don't want them to be like the next World of Warcraft expansion. I wake up with something in my head talking to me.
I mean, we already did that. That was Nazoth. You wear the hat.
Yeah, but he didn't. I didn't wear the hat. I never put that hat on. I didn't even do that quest line. Y'all were getting corrupted and I was fine.
All right. Well, we're going to move on then to our last question here, which is from our friend Verdigris, which is, well, it's about Spider-Man. So we're going to answer this one. I saw Madam Web. It's super fun. I thought I'd ask the most knowledgeable spider readers I know about her. So what's the whole deal with the spider totem and Madam Web's web of fate? Glancing at three wikis, there's three answers on whether Cassandra is a mutant, a mutate like Peter, or a human psychic. But it seems all the ways the spider people get spider powers are equally connected. If Spider's Man and Madam Web have had a conversation, what would they talk about? Spider's Man, for those of you that don't know, is literally a Spider-Man constructed of a bunch of spiders that work together in a spider suit because they consumed Peter Parker, consumed his identity, and then became a superhero. That is just
think the swamp thing with spiders instead of plants.
Yeah. So Madam Web is an interesting thing. The spider totems thing is an interesting thing because she was first introduced in like the early 80s. I want to say like it was a Romita Jr. Edition where she was actually at that time a mutant. There wasn't any difference in the comic books during the time to really differentiate. Even Spider-Man was considered a mutant because his genes had mutated after he was bitten.
Okay, I'm going to have to disagree with you. They did have a difference. They even commented on it a few times. Like, for instance, the Fantastic Four were not considered mutants. Spider-Man wasn't.
Fair.
Even though they were mutated, there was even a story where Magneto went to the Savage Land and made mutates, which are people that are mutated against their will, as opposed to people who are born with the gene and mutated.
And I was going to say, this also came into a deep conversation when the, why can't I think of his name? The dinosaur guy, the dinosaur doctor.
Sauron? Or yeah, Dr.
Sauron, where Sauron was literally doing the exact same thing. And the whole discussion came up of what is a mutant versus what is a mutate. Regardless. Yes. Yeah. But she was introduced as, and she was a mutant. She was a clairvoyant mutant that was, eventually put onto life support and, had been leveraged by Peter multiple times to, help sort of solve cases, right? Like they're like this weird, like almost noirish thing going on. The spider totem thing really started happening much, much later.
Yeah. That was Dan Slott. And I honestly going to say this now. A lot of people don't like Dan Slott as a writer. They don't like his Spider-Man. They don't like what he did. But the spider totem thing, which he picked up when Straczynski dropped it, J. Michael Straczynski started it and didn't go anywhere with it. Slott picked it up and he ran with that thing. And I honestly think it's one of the more interesting changes to Spider-Man in the past, I don't know, 40 years, 60 years.
And I would tend to agree.
Yeah. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're perfectly fine. I agree. Like, I think it's one of the more interesting things because it gives... There's been a bunch of comics revolving around the Spider-Verse, and you've seen maybe the movies and maybe you've read Edge of Spider-Verse. And if you haven't and you're interested in this, I highly recommend reading it because you're going to learn a lot about, in particular, the totems and this particular thing. In particular, pick the Inheritor War. The Inheritor War is where basically this family, and I'm air quoting family of beings, travels the multiverse, consuming the power of particularly Spider-Man because they're totem eaters. And this starts a whole chain. The Web of Destiny and Life, or Life and Destiny, I think it's Life and Destiny, is constructed of a bunch of different aspects. You have the Great Weaver, the Gatekeeper. You have the Bride. I believe there's the Pattern Maker and then the Master Weaver. And there's a few others. But they're all sort of aspects of this like unified spider force. And these are all aspects of essentially an animalistic totemic society. And it's not just spiders. They've now been changing it so that there's a reason Spider-Man's foes tend to all be animal based in some capacity. And not just Kraven. I'm talking like the Rhino and things like that. The Vulture.
Yeah, the Rhino, the Vulture. Yeah, yeah.
There's a reason that there's a lot of that. The Lizard, that a lot of those tend to pop up is because they're almost competing totems. And the Peter and in some cases, I think his clone Kane, not Ben Reilly, but Kane in particular, became aspects of the Other, which is one of the avatar forces of the totem, the spider totem. Cindy Moon or Silk is the aspect of the Bride. And there's a whole bunch of them. And I'm trying to think of, there's just so much here I'm trying to condense down. I really apologize.
Yeah. Like you haven't even mentioned the time Ben Reilly brought Madam Web back to life, but then she died again. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
There's actually the different person is Madam Web now in the comics too, Julia Carpenter. And man, is that an explain?
Oh yeah. But the it all starts with the original Great Weaver or the original totemic spirit before Madam Web ever existed. which was the spirit, the original Spider-Man, Kwaku Anansi. And I apologize if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. And it is exactly as you think it was. He is essentially the stories of the god of Anansi are him. And so part of the web of life, part of Madame Web's journey is to sort of find those that are worthy to accept the curse of Spider-Man. Because there's been this joke that, you know, Peter says, oh, the Parker curse. It's not the Parker curse. It's the Spider-Man curse. Every single person who takes on the mantle of Spider-Man has suffered some great humbling tragedy. There is not one of them that hasn't. And part of that is because the adage that Uncle Ben told Peter when he was dying of great power, with great power comes great responsibility. That's sort of the same thing that Anansi has. He doesn't want those that would be part of his lineage, part of his war, or part of his hero corpse, I guess we'll call it, to be those that aren't worthy, that don't understand the gravity of what they're doing. And it becomes a big complicated thing, but the spider totems are essentially gods. That's what they are. They are a pantheon of spider related gods that operate through avatars on essentially the material plane. It really adds some interesting mythic mythos to Spider-Man in a way that doesn't feel like it's just hemmed on. It feels like it was always there because and I'm going to shut up and let Matt talk here in a minute, but they reference things that have happened throughout the years. Well, again, like whether it's Peter Parker or Kane becoming the avatar of the other, or Peter Parker from Earth 982, Cindy Moon as the bride, Benji Parker as the avatar of the Scion, Anna May Parker, as the pattern maker, who also is one like the daughter of Spider-Man from Earth, I think it's 18119, has like precognitive, like she can hear or receive visions. And so she can actually understand things that are going. She becomes instrumental in fighting the inheritors who want to unravel all of like existence, essentially. Various other versions of Peter Parker become avatars of it. I think Uncle Ben, who became a Spider-Man in one of the universes when Peter died, actually becomes a totem at one point as well. And I'm going to stop and I'm going to let Matt talk.
I mean, I think like you probably know more about individual issues because I didn't read all of it. I read like the big stuff, like when the Spider-Verse stories came out and stuff. But one of the things to keep in mind is what they did, what Slott did with this was to essentially create a meta myth around Spider-Man. Like, it comes down to, like, do you remember in the original stories, Peter tried to be famous and rich at first.
Yeah, he wanted to make money.
Yeah, and that wasn't, like, when Straczynski started it, he created Ezekiel Sims, who was this mysterious mentor figure who essentially had similar powers to Spider-Man because he, too, was a spider totem.
Mm-hmm.
And Sims did the same thing. And it's implied that it's because...
That's why Sims in the movie, by the way.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Yeah, and Kwaku Anansi is hinted at also being arrogant.
Yes.
And short-sighted, but he learns. He learns that he can't be like that. And it repeats. When someone becomes the spider totem, they often repeat that kind of cycle. They have to have something bad happen so that they learn the price of abusing this. Because it's a divine thing. I mean, the whole reason it exists is because Anansi made a deal with his father, who was himself a sky deity. It's much like the Asgardians in the comics. Now, in the comics, the Asgardians, the Olympians, they're real gods. They're not alien beings. They're divine beings who rise on Earth. So are the various animal totem people. They're tied into a more shamanic magic system, mm-hmm. but they're tied into that aspect of Gaia. The same being who gave birth to Atun, who became the Demiurge, who is now living in the sun, and you don't want it coming out of the sun. Not many beings in creation could stand against it if it did. Not many. And that's the kind of resonance that, yes, you were bitten by a radioactive spider. Yes, that's how you got your powers. But how you got your powers isn't as important as what your powers are. Your powers are, you are a man who is also like a spider. What are spiders? They're intelligent. They're crafty. They lay traps. They lie in ambush. There's a lot about spiders that informs Spider-Man, even though he never really understood that.
Yeah, there's a thing that comes to mind when you're talking about that, and I think you'll remember this. It was after Peter had the black suit, and it was in particular with the Beyonder, and there was this exchange between them where they're talking about it, and as he walks away, one of the things Beyonder says is, he has more power than even he knows he has. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of all of this stuff sort of stems from that rough idea.
Well, yeah. Here's a thing that goes back. When Thanos got his first shot at becoming God, it was the first time he did it. He got his hands on a cosmic cube and the Avengers and Captain Marvel stopped him. Second time he was on a space station and the thing, the Avengers and Spider-Man all got sucked into this. And it was Spider-Man who beat him.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all of them, the rest of them couldn't touch him. It was Spider-Man who beat him, who beat Thanos. When Fire-Lord came to Earth angry and picked a fight and Spider-Man was trying to de-escalate it the whole time, Fire-Lord's a herald of Galactus. Fire-Lord has the power cosmic. Spider-Man beat him unconscious.
Yeah.
He was terrified the whole time, but he just went at him and did what he did best. He distracted him with patter. He kept irritating him so he couldn't think straight. And then he just exploded and hit him the picture. I've always remembered it because it was one of Romita Jr.'s best pictures. It's just, there's Fire Lord reeling and there's just 20 Spider-Men around him all hitting him because Peter's literally jumping around and hitting him. Quicksilver is probably faster in pure terms than Spider-Man. Spider-Man's got better reaction time.
There is also the old adage that Spider-Man was potentially stronger than the Hulk.
Yeah, potentially.
I don't know if that still holds with the new mythology of the Hulk, but at one point in time, he was considered stronger than the Hulk. The Hulk could not separate Peter from anything he was attached to, no matter how angry he got.
Yeah, he could rip the thing that he was attached to out of the ground, but he couldn't separate him, yeah.
And for a long time, for a long time in the comics, that's why where you saw exchanges between, in particular, Hulk and Spider-Man, the Hulk had respect for him.
Yeah. He still kind of does because there was that Joe Fixit thing where he punched Joe Fixit into orbit. Granted, he had the power cosmic, but.
But I mean, so did the Kingpin. The Kingpin also beat the snot out of Joe Fixit, which is a whole other thing. But
yeah. But at any rate, the thing about Spider-Man is his power level and his potential has always been something that people he's strong now, but we don't really see him use it. Just one example Joe just mentioned. the adhesion that Peter can use that can be so strong that you can't rip him off a wall without bringing the wall with him. Kane used that to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
Kane would put his hand on people's faces and then he would just take the face off because he would just bond himself to it and then just pull it off. Between his strength and the fact that his grip was so strong, he could just yank faces off with it. And Peter could do that, but that's not Peter. Peter
also, speaking of things that Peter could do that he chooses not to do, people forget that he has two stingers, very much similar to Wolverine's claws. Kane uses them all the time. Peter has them as well. He just never uses them.
Yeah, he does not eject those things. He doesn't even think about them.
He's done it twice.
Yeah.
And both times it was in alternate universes, one where Venom was about to kill his child and wife. And the other one was, I think, with Morlun, when Morlun came to like devour him. Those are the only times he's really done it. Kane, all the time.
Yeah, and for that matter, Peter has the potential for organic web shooters. He's actually had organic web shooters in the past. Yeah, but he doesn't use them anymore for the same reason. Peter doesn't want to not be Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, Peter, if you talk about characters in comic books who have a real strong, I don't want to kill people, I want to help people vibe, Spider-Man is above Captain America there.
100%.
Captain America doesn't want to kill people, but he'll do it if he thinks he absolutely has to save lives or whatever, because the dude was in World War II. He is a soldier. Peter is not a soldier. Peter doesn't want to be a soldier. Peter wants to help people because he knows what it's like to be on the bottom. He knows what it's like to look at someone you loved dead. He knows what it's like to lose.
Yeah, he knows what it's like to lose everything.
Yeah, and he doesn't want that for anybody. Peter will go out of his way to not even hurt his villains.
Which is why you have interesting exchanges too later on. Like right now in the comics, you had I talking about Peter, but also like Miles, because of that code of Peter's, there's a thing where Miles is going after, I think it's Tombstone, but Tombstone has the Rhino's girlfriend, and Rhino and Miles wind up working together. And Miles asks him, why are you doing this? Why are you helping? And it's like, because that's what the other Spider-Man would do. One of his greatest villains of all time, because it's like he was being redeemed through all these fights or all these conflicts, because that's what Peter does. And that's mm-hmm. what part of being a part of that web of life and destiny is.
Yeah.
The web exactly. of going back to it, the totem of the pantheon of the spider is about weaving and healing the universe, the multiverse. It's about holding things together. It's about making things okay. If you look at
Peter,
it.
Yeah. Go ahead. Peter does that on a small scale.
But they
that's
all
what Peter
do that.
Does. Yeah, they all do it in their own ways. Peter's way is to do it individually with people. That doesn't mean he can't do it in a different way or a bigger way. But Peter's power is restrained. I don't even know if restrained is the right word. It's channeled so that it doesn't do more damage than it prevents. Like Peter, mm-hmm. when Peter loses it, and there have been times. I mean, the famous one is the Kingpin story where he literally beat the Kingpin
back in
16
black.
Ways from Sunday. But to me, the two examples are there's a Spider-Man annual where it was Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four, and it's the debut of the mutant Karma.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you guys have ever read it, but there's a whole weird thing going on. At the very end, Karma possesses Spider-Man. And when he wakes up, her brother, who's this villain who's been, you know, possessing people and destroying their minds, is dead at his feet. And he's like, what? Oh God, what did she make me do? This guy was a sociopath who was doing horrible things to everyone around him. And Peter would never have killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So she did. She killed him with his hands. Another time was another story. This one was with Doctor Strange. And basically Dr. Octopus and Dr. Doom were both dealing with Dormammu. But Octopus didn't want to be involved because he knew, I don't understand this at all. Anyway, he kind of leaked it to Spider-Man and Dr. Doom. This is happening. Help. I still hate you, but yeah. At the end of it all, Doom betrayed Dormammu. Dormammu betrayed Doom. You know, the things you expect. But at the very end, Spider-Man is walking away from it. They've stopped it. He's walking away. Doctor Strange kind of talked to him like a jerk at the end. He sort of acted like he couldn't possibly understand these. He's just walking away, and there's like this old dead tree he walks past. Someone says something to him, and he just reaches out and smashes the tree
mm-hmm.
with like one hand and just keeps walking. The tree was huge. It was a giant effing tree, and he just smashed the thing into splinters on his way past it. And that's the kind of thing he constantly holds himself back from doing.
But
that's part of this whole this whole web of life in Destiny, the whole Spider-Verse thing. It's about the fact that that's the kind of people that it wants to reach.
And that's why
Miles is different than Peter, but they both want to help people.
And their tragedies are different. But the idea behind part of it too, like if you look at why Mephisto is so interested in Peter, it's because of that. He's interested in all the spider people because they are god level power avatars.
And he goes after Miles too and tries to do something like that to him.
Yeah. So the Madam Web being introduced as far as like movie goes is actually introducing a lot of people to this for the first time, especially because of the other movies like Across the Spider-Verse. They haven't touched on this yet, but well,
there's a cameo.
There is the
second Spider-Verse one.
There absolutely is. And there's some hints at them starting to get into that potentially in the third movie, but this is starting to introduce the deeper mythos or the more modern mythos of Spider-Man. And I actually think it's really interesting. Again, really, if you, this is something you're interested in, I highly recommend reading the Inheritor series. It goes into all of this in depth across the board, explains everything, explains why there's avatars across the multiverse. And in the most recent one, there is actually a dagger that can actually essentially blink the Spider-Man out of existence, where like if they are stabbed with it, they're cut from the web of life. They never existed and people lose memory about it. This is actually where recently the Spider-Boy comic, which is wild and you should read it, by the way, where this comes from, because after they fix everything and bring people back, they bring this person back as well, but that's a whole other thing. But one of the things is it's I can never pronounce it. I apologize. Anansi, the original Spider-Man, is the one doing it to make sure that the only ones that are there are the worthy ones. And until they can defeat him, they're essentially like, he essentially takes them out of the game. It's fascinating, but I would start with the Inheritor series. It is probably the best modern Spider-Man story if you're interested in the more mystical side of it. Anything else to add before we go?
No, I think that's pretty good. I mean, there is a ton more we could talk about, but I think that in order for us to stop this show when it's not 3 hours long, we should be done here.
Yeah, and if this is something you guys want to hear more about, we're more than happy to do that. As we're in the time between expansions, we are probably going to be looking at doing some in between, some off stuff. We're going to be still doing some of our, we'll continue our What If series, but we're probably going to be looking at particularly doing episodes about other games or other lore or other story between now and the next expansion. So if you have any topics that you'd want, be sure to send those in to us. But Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, better chance at having your question answered on our podcast, or the Q&A ads-free site experience. Again, thank you very much for joining us, folks. We'll see you next week.